This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Good Things on the Bigger Picture, where we speak to good people doing good things. I'm Julia Jacobs. Part of her name means peace and bravery, and Mary Shanti Dairiam has certainly lived up to that, spending the better part of her life tirelessly advocating for human rights and women's rights. The founding director of the International Women's Rights Action Watch, Asia Pacific, she has served as an expert assisting key UN agencies, including the United Nations Gender Equality Task Force on the Convention for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW, and she was on that committee from 2004 to 2008. So in the lead up to Human Rights Day, I'm going to be speaking to Shanti to track her journey from English teacher to activist and to discuss why she continues to fight against inequality even today. Welcome, Shanti. How are you today?
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm very well, Julia. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure to have you back on the show. So I've had the pleasure of speaking to you a couple of years ago. You know, we spoke about CEDAW. We talked about your career very briefly, but today we want to focus on that, isn't it? Your career. And I do know that you were trained as an English teacher, Shanti, but yeah, things sort of changed for you, right? And you started...
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. And you started volunteering with the Federation of Family Planning Association in the late 1970s. Tell me, what happened to you then?
See, I was a teacher and I took up voluntary work with the Federation of Family Planning. Today it's called the Federation of Family, it's called the Federation of Reproductive Health Associations. They moved from a more narrow focus on just contraception to the reproductive health of women, and especially this was after the International Conference on Population and Development. So, but at that time it was the Family Planning Associations, the Federation. And I went in, I took up voluntary work. I used to do some of their education programs, youth programs in my spare time. And when a full-time opportunity to take up a full-time job in the Federation came up, I liked what I was doing so much that I gave up teaching. And I went in, took that up as a full-time work. And when I went there, my exposure to life itself was very different. As a school teacher in the high school, I was teaching in Mara Science Junior Colleges. I was teaching English. I was taught English in a private Chinese school. You just see students in front of you, little young people, you know, and you're just teaching them. But there, I saw life. I saw human beings, adults, women in particular, because more than 90% of the clients in the clinic, because we were running clinics as well, were women, and just ordinary folks. They were not from the higher socioeconomic group, and the exposure that I got to their lives for me was very shocking. Mm-hmm. It was the first time I began to realize that in this world, women, many of them, are not able. The first lesson that I learned was they are not able to set the terms of their intimate relationships. They are not equal in their intimate relationship. We talk a lot about the public sphere of women and education, employment, and all the rest of it, but it starts within their intimate family relationships, husband, wife, spouse, and they were completely dominated within that relationship. And that was the first shock that I got, and it had very disastrous implications for them. I mean, they couldn't set the terms. They couldn't choose when to have sex. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whatever you want to call it. Today we call it marital rape, but it is still, society doesn't accept it. It says if you are married, you have already given overall consent to sex, but it can be brutal and demeaning when a woman has to have sex without her consent, even if it's her husband. I saw that. I saw violence, sexual violence. I saw physical violence. I saw emotional violence. I saw they couldn't negotiate anything in their life. And even to the extent that they would have vaginal infections, not like the terrible sexually transmitted diseases, but they will have infections. And the clinic staff would tell them that they can be treated, but that same treatment they can go and take the pills or creams or whatever is being given to them. The husbands must also be taking that treatment. Otherwise, definitely the infection is coming from both sides. I mean, and if he is not treated, you're going to, the infection will recur again and again. But they would be terrified. They said that they will be thrown out of the house. They said even that they had an infection. They would be blamed about where they got that infection. The husband would never acknowledge that any infection can come from him, that she must have been up to something. So they would not even talk about it. They could not even make a personal decision to take contraception. Mm. Some of them would come secretly without telling the rest of the family that they were coming for contraception because they didn't want more children. So for me, and then the physical, sexual, emotional violence I saw, and there was no remedy at that time. This was, I started work in the Federation 1981.
Okay.
I worked there for about 6.5 years. And during this time, there was no domestic violence law. Violence against women was not seen as a public crime. It was a family issue, dispute or conflict inside the family or personal relationship issue. You could not come out and talk about it anywhere else. So there was no public policy on violence against women, least of all a law. So even the clinic staff, although they were very, very sympathetic to the women, would give them some comfort, but there was no remedy, no solution to it.
Okay.
And in the midst of it, Women's Aid Organization broke that silence and set up a shelter, for the first shelter for abused women in 1982.
Okay.
And that sparked a deep interest in me. I said, at least there is something now that somewhere we can go to where we can ask these women to come to see how to address this problem in their lives, this demeaning, humiliating problem in their lives of violence. And of course, all the attendant lack of decision-making capacity and everything else. So I used to use language such as personhood. Women had no personhood. They were not a person. They were an appendage within the family. You know, it was either a wife, or she was a daughter-in-law, or she was a daughter. It was very much strong here in Malaysia in the 70s, 80s. But once violence against women was seen as not a silent issue, as a private issue, Women's Aid has done a tremendous program and publicly acknowledging that violence has to be addressed as a public issue.
Mm-hmm.
I took a great interest, and I volunteered with Women's Aid after that.
Mm-hmm. And this was in the 80s, right? And you...
Women's Aid set up their shelter in 1982. I joined as a member a couple of years after that. By 1984, I became a member. And I'm a member there until today. Today, after all these years, I've done many things at Women's Aid. I've even slept with the women in the shelter overnight. So I was very hands-on. And I would now and then get into the executive committee. Well, it's been more than 30 years of my involvement, but suddenly I was approached this year to stand for elections at the annual general meeting for president's post. I was totally taken aback that I was being asked to be president after all these years, and I never saw myself in that kind of position. But since I was being asked, I said, okay, let me give it a try at least one term. So currently I'm the current president of WAO, so my association and affiliation with WAO is very strong. It will never break.
Yeah? Okay.
So I went in there. So that is what working with the family planning and this resistance to women making a decision about their reproductive health, their sexual rights, was the first spur for me to think about women's rights.
Okay. And it was during this time as well, right? When you were with the WAO in the mid-1980s that you started lobbying for the enactment of the Domestic Violence Act because, I mean,
yes.
It was lacking, right? I mean, tell me about that. You know, that was, I mean, it was eventually passed, but only, you know, in 1994. I mean, that must have been quite a journey as well.
Yeah. Of course, Women's Aid provided services, support services for women. giving them immediate safety if she was in a very risky situation. 3 months we would keep them and let them talk and see what they wanted to do with their lives. All that we were doing, but there was no way that we could promote the fact that that violence was a violation.
Mm.
You know, it happened, yeah, but we'll help you in one way or another. So then Women's Aid said, no, we need to look at the law and bring in a law. So at that time, actually in the late 70s itself, the Association of Women Lawyers and the National Council of Women's Organizations organized a workshop in which they identified all the discriminatory provisions in the law, discrimination against women, and they produced a document which had many laws which either a new law or laws that had to be amended. And one of the laws that had to be amended, of course, was, I mean, we had to be created, we had to have a new law, was on domestic violence, which was, it was not a crime until then. The other piece of legislation where violence is concerned is laws pertaining to rape.
Okay.
Although in the penal code, it already said that rape was a crime, and maximum sentence that a court could give was 20 years. It was there in the law. But the attitude of the legal fraternity, the judges, was that even for rape, they were giving very minimal sentences, even though maximum of 20 was possible. So in this process of looking at all the laws that needed to be amended, the women's groups put in that it cannot be left to the complete discretion of the judges. We were all men at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have a lot of women judges, there's more diversity, better different perspectives in the law. But at the time they were all men, and they were giving very minimal sentences. And of course, the courts would always say, woman is not telling the truth. They would even caution the prosecution and everybody that before the case was heard, that bear in mind that women may not be telling the truth.
Oh, wow.
It was not only here. It was even in the UK and in Europe it was like that. So minimal sentences. And all sorts of excuses would be given. There was a case, it was not rape, it was a molestation. And in Lyft, a man sexually molested a girl. He touched her inappropriately, and when she complained, the court hardly gave a very minimal sentence. And the judge said, well, this woman is really beautiful. How do you blame the man?
Oh, my goodness.
You know, that kind of conversation in the courts. So we said minimum of 5 years, nothing less than that.
Mm.
So the discretion of the judge to give any kind of sentence was taken away. So until today, the minimum is 5 years. And it's much better now. There's more awareness in the courts about things like rape. So that was the other correction, the amendment. And we also looked at abortion, because there were many cases of women getting pregnant because of rape.
Yeah.
And abortion was not lawful. You could not have abortion under any circumstance. Unless, if I'm not mistaken, it is to save the life. The pregnancy, the continuation of the pregnancy would threaten her life, then you could have, which was not useful. So we also proposed that abortion, that you must widen the grounds. There was an exception given. Abortion was illegal except if it threatened her life. So we said that exception must be widened.
Mm.
So we asked, as a consequence of rape, but the then Attorney General was very wise and very sympathetic. He said, if you say as a consequence of rape, rape is a legal concept. So you'll have to prove in court that she was raped.
Right.
And if you can't prove that, then you cannot ask for the abortion. So don't say as a consequence of rape. He widened it to say if the continuation of the pregnancy will be harmful to her physical and mental health. then so that opened it up.
Yeah.
So women were, of course, emotionally traumatized by that pregnancy, which was because of that act of forced sex on her. So that is what the law says today. It widened that. But the government clinics and the health ministry has been reluctant to provide this attendant services, abortion services. Women mostly, I don't know currently today whether they are doing it, but there is an organization that is advocating for hospital clinics to provide abortion services if it is certified by a medical practitioner that the pregnancy is damaging to her mental and physical health. But private sector opened it up. But the problem with private sector is that they charge a lot for that abortion. So that was the other thing. And there were many others, including income tax. A woman can file for income tax on her own personally. Otherwise, it was a combined income tax. Distribution of assets. If a person dies interstate, a woman dies, everything went to the husband. Without will. But if a man dies, half of it will go to his parents, and only some of it will come to the wife, the widow.
Right.
So all that has changed to make it equal. There were several provisions like that were changed. So that is when the domestic violence law was picked up, and women's groups brought in a model domestic violence law from Australia, and they sat. Ministry of Women, even today it's not called the Ministry of Women, it's the Ministry of Social Development, Community, Family and Social Development, but women's rights is a component of that, a portfolio within that. That ministry was in charge, and they set up a drafting committee. It involved women's groups, but it had attorney general's office people, it had police, it had health services, it had religious authorities to draft, and it took 4 years. I think the process started much earlier, and although we had presented this in the late 70s, early 80s, it took a decade before the government set up a procedure for drafting.
Okay.
So that was around 1990, and it took 4 years of consistent work to draft that law. The interesting feature of that law is women's groups wanted a hybrid law. You criminalize wife beating, it's a crime, it can go under the penal code, but you also gave options to women for civil remedies. They don't charge the husband for a criminal offense and send him to jail or anything like that, but they want separation, divorce, compensation, custody of their children. You see, that the other piece of legislation that changed because of women's groups is the guardianship law. Women were not guardians of their children.
Mm.
Only the husband was a guardian. Even the woman could not even apply for a passport for her child or change this girl's child's school. That changed to give equal guardianship. So many laws were changed, and then this amended, and then this... It took 4 years of consistent drafting, and we wanted both a kind of hybrid law, civil and criminal, because women would be reluctant to have their husband's child, because the police will have to prosecute. They withdraw the reports. They don't want the police to proceed. So, but we were advised by legal experts that, because the religious authorities were objecting to criminalizing domestic violence, because they said it's a family matter and the Sharia, you can have the same law, but if the domestic violence happened to a Muslim woman, the Sharia court will adjudicate.
Oh.
And if it happens to a non-Muslim woman, it will go to the penal, the criminal court, civil criminal court. And somebody had said to us that this is very problematic to have the same legislation following two different procedures, and even the police said it will be very difficult for us to do this. So we were advised, make it completely criminal, because criminal law is federal law in the country.
Yeah.
It doesn't go under the Sharia, except for Sharia offenses, certain offenses like drinking and close proximity. Kalwat, all those things go under Sharia, but rape, violence, even domestic violence, all comes under the civil procedure. So they said, make it completely criminal, and religion will have nothing to do with whether a man should beat his wife or not.
Okay.
You know, it shouldn't be a religious matter.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So we consented with reluctance, because we knew that women would be reluctant. But it's much better now. Women are actually consenting to having their husbands charged. It's slowly picked up. So after that, it took another 2 years after the law was drafted for it to be enacted and enforced. You had to set the date, and the then minister was reluctant. And a lot of advocacy took place before she agreed. Now it's domestic violence is a crime. And it's very interesting. You see, some of my conversations with men, even taxi drivers, they were unaware that there is a law that says they cannot beat their wives.
Oh.
And when I tell them that, they are totally shocked. He said, really? She can take me to court? I said, yes, she can take you to court. And it kind of frightens them. So the law, even if the woman doesn't have her husband charged, the fact that the law, the state, is telling society wife beating is a crime can gradually, not overnight, but gradually change the mindset. You know?
Yeah.
And change that culture. So the law has had that, in my view, it has had that effect. So, and we also put into the regulations, you know, the other, because this is a subsidiary law of the penal code, the domestic violence law is not a law that stands by itself. So the severity of the crime comes from the penal code. Although the domestic violence law defines certain aspects like emotional harm, emotional violence, it's not just physical assault. It also says that coercing a woman to do something she doesn't want to do, or preventing her from doing something she should be doing, like going out to work, her independence in many ways, constitutes domestic violence. But how it will be punished, how it will be regarded as a severe crime, you have to read the penal code provisions. You have to read the penal code along with the domestic violence law. And therefore, the two definitely come together. We have to read it together. And that is how it is now being implemented. So we've had protection orders specific to this kind of violence. There was protection order under the penal code, but it would not have been effective if you just talked about all kinds of violence. It had to show the severity, you know, where a police will have to prosecute.
Okay.
Right. Seizable crime, they say, where the police will prosecute. If it is not, you know, the definition in the penal code doesn't apply, it is not seen as severe crime, then if the woman wants her husband prosecuted, she has to hire her own criminal lawyer and file her own case in the criminal court.
Mm-hmm.
But then we saw that a lot of the crime against women, the domestic violence, may not fall under that kind of severity. See, the point about domestic violence is, it's not a one-off assault, severe assault, where somebody took a parang and slashed somebody.
Yeah.
And so a weapon was used, there was blood, or the bone was broken. Penal code has an answer for that. One incident, and it may happen most of the time between people who are not intimately related. Could be a neighbor, it could be somebody on the street, it could be whatever. But domestic violence happens between members of the family, husband, wife, and so on. And the couple, the individuals concerned, are living under that roof continuously, day after day.
Yeah.
So domestic violence may not be that virulent that it is a severe crime, but it is repetitive, almost daily. And it is you, I'm threatened, even threats. The husband says, I'll bash you if you don't do this now.
Yeah.
So he puts the fear of violence into her to control her and make her compliant to his wishes. So, and it repeats itself. It goes on over months. So that kind of repetitive offense is not there in the penal code. So once the police, you make a police report, they will receive the report. Now, before they would not receive the report, they say this is not a crime. They now know, and they are recording it as domestic violence. We couldn't get domestic violence statistics before because they won't record it as violence. Now they are recording, so all that is happening, but they will not prosecute it if it is not severe enough according to the penal code. Okay. So it will be no further action. So one of the things we managed to get into the regulations of that act was any report that comes to the police, they must investigate. They must go question the husband, question the neighbors, ask the husband for a statement, whatever. They can then, after 24 hours of investigation or 48 hours of investigation, they can drop it and say no further action. But there will be an initial police presence.
Okay.
And conversation with the alleged perpetrator. And that intimidates the perpetrator. And he realizes that what he has done is receiving police attention.
There are consequences, yeah?
Yeah, consequences. So all that are the changes and the improvements that has happened that gives protection to women. So we have interim protection order. While the investigation is taking place, a protection order can be given. We have introduced emergency protection order, where an imminent incident of violence is going to happen. The husband is waving a knife in front of the wife, and somehow some neighbor who has seen this is able to call the police, or she's able to call the police. So a quick protection order can be given. It doesn't have to go through a magistrate and everything. The welfare department officers can help with the protection order.
Yeah.
Instead of going to others, you have to go to a magistrate, the police have to take it, go to the magistrate, it'll take more than 48 hours to get a protection order. All that has been streamlined. So the protection for women is much better now with all these changes. So yes, I'm not the only one. There's a whole stream of women who participated in that. And it was at that time that the Joint Action Group, you hear of the Joint Action Group, was set up.
Okay.
And in the early 90s, late 70s, early 1980s, this awareness among the women's group that violence must be made visible and the law must have a role came in very strongly. And that is why the discrimination in the law project was carried out. And new organizations were set up. AWAM was set up at that time. Women's Crisis Center was set up at that time. Empower was set up at that time. So young women's group, other there was YWCA and Women's Institute. It was set up during the British time, and the National Council of Women's Organizations.
Yeah.
But today, the vibrant young women's groups that we have were set up around that time, starting with violence against women. But those groups have also now advocating very strongly for the elimination of discrimination and inequality.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's women's status, a low status, that gives the impunity for violence against women.
Yeah.
She's not seen as equal. There's a lot of discrimination. She has sometimes no options in life. And therefore, she has to stay in an abusive relationship. So now women's groups are very much involved with discrimination, with CEDAW. And then CEDAW came in. Malaysia ratified CEDAW in 1995. And so women's groups are using that framework and taking their issues to the United Nations when the CEDAW committee reviews governments. So they're doing international advocacy as well on equality. All of those are the developments that started late 70s, 80s, 90s. And the 90s, you must remember also, was the time of the world conferences on women.
Mm.
1993 was a conference on human rights, Vienna, and then 90, 1994 on the Conference on Population and Development, and 1995 was a Fourth World Conference on Women. And they gave a great impetus to governments. The national machinery for women, like women's ministries, women's departments in government, was set up around that time.
Okay.
It was set up with the first conference. The first conference on women was Nairobi, 1975.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the resolutions of that conference was there must be a specialized government institution that will promote and protect women's rights. And that was why the women's departments, women's ministries were also set up.
Okay. We're just going to go for a quick break, Shanti. When we come back, maybe we can talk a little bit more about CEDAW. I'm speaking today to Mary Shanti Dairiam. She's a human rights and women's rights advocate. She's our featured guest today on Good Things. When we come back, we'll find out more about her work involving CEDAW. Stay tuned. This is Good Things on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Good Things on The Bigger Picture. I'm Julia Jacobs. This is a show, of course, where we speak to good people doing good things. And my guest today is Mary Shanti Dairiam. She is a human rights and women's rights advocate. She has been in this business for a very, very long time. And as you heard before the break, so much change came, you know, from those times where she started back in the 70s and 80s, you know, which women like me, you know, take for granted the rights that we have now. You know, those were long fought for rights that people like Shanti fought for. But of course, Shanti, you know, I mean, this is something we've spoken about before. You are a huge proponent of CEDAW, which is the Convention for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. Tell me about that. You know, why is it that you believe this is the equality standard that we should follow and the instrument that we have to work with?
Okay. You see, it also started because of my work on women's reproductive rights and sexual health and rights, because there was so much resistance, not only at the personal and private level, but also societal level, you know, this enabling women to control fertility, to be able to have a decision-making, a self-determination on their reproductive health issues, was a lot of resistance, not only here in Malaysia, but all over, even in Europe. And I came across at that time, somewhere in the 80s, I came across the fact that there was an international treaty called CEDAW. Mm-hmm. I read an article about it. And when I read that article, two things occurred to me. There was one treaty specific to the elimination of discrimination against women, and that was CEDAW. I said, this is what we need, because we have to promote women as equal citizens, equal partners in everything. Secondly, we needed international standards for this equality. Otherwise, culture and tradition, interpretations of religion influence what we believe is equality.
Yeah.
Women are not seen as equals of men. So this treaty is saying unequally women and men are equal, and they should be equal partners in everything and have equal benefit. They should be agents of change and equal beneficiaries of change. I said, this is what we need to promote. And I read that governments, if they ratify it, undertake certain obligations to eliminate discrimination and enable the fulfillment of rights. So I took a strong interest in that and started even attending some of the CEDAW reviewed governments who have ratified the treaty every 4 years. I attended some of those meetings to see how the governments reviewed, and I said, this is what we need, both the international standards and the principle of equality in everything. We just can't promote health or education without equality underpinning it. Yeah?
Yeah.
That's how I took an interest. And then I got so involved, I attended meetings, I raised funds for myself to go to these meetings. And then I saw that there was an international organization from University of Minnesota in the U.S. that was liaising with there's an expert committee, CEDAW committee, on which I sat later, that is reviewing governments. And when governments would come and say all kinds of things about what they were doing, wonderful things about themselves, but this Minnesota was gathering data on countries that were reporting and presenting what they called a shadow report
okay.
to the committee. And I was present at many of these presentations of Shari Report by the University of Minnesota, but there was a certain level of discomfort for me because I felt if these are about what is happening to women, the discrimination, etc., the failure of governments in their own countries to women, an international organization, a university from the U.S., presenting this information about all the countries of the world is not as powerful as the women themselves came into the United Nations and talked to this committee about what is happening. So I said, I will start a program for Asia and the Pacific where we will educate women about, nobody knew about this treaty at that time, and this was in the late 80s. I said, I will educate women and make them write their own shadow reports and take it to the CEDAW committee. That is how, and the University of Minnesota folks were very supportive. They said, yes, do that because we can't do it. So I raised money, and by the time I got this started, I did the proposal in 92, money came in 93, and I started. I had been working at that time with the Asia Pacific Forum on Women, Law and Development, which is a regional organization on law and development. I had taken a break of more than a year because I went and did my master's in gender and development. One of the things that propelled me into that, as you saw, I was doing a lot of work on violence against women. And then I went into APWLD and I said, I must do more on the law. And so I took up a position there. But then I said, law alone is not enough. The ideology of gender and inequality that it promotes, that gender ideology, I need to understand more theoretically and conceptually. Mm. Otherwise, it's just what I see and hear around me. So I took a break from APWLD and I did, in 1990, I did a master's in gender and development at the University of Sussex. I came back wanting to do this Asia-Pacific program on CEDAW, but the existing groups were not interested in branching out. Oh, we are working on health, we are working on the law, we don't think we can take on another theme. I said, this is not another theme. It's a theme that will strengthen your own advocacy on whatever you're doing, equality for women in the area of health or whatever. But it was like too much for them. They didn't have the exposure that I had to what CEDAW could achieve. So I said, why am I looking for another organization to park this program? I'll start it and do it myself. I'll start a new organization. And that is how Asia Pacific was started. I got funding by 1993 and I started it and set it up here, and it is still running. So today, Asia Pacific has connections in about 140 countries of the world, but we work primarily with women's groups, strengthening their capacity to raise the issues of equality and non-discrimination with their governments and at the international level with the UN, and to come back with recommendations from the CEDAW committee of what their governments could do. That is how CEDAW and Asia Pacific started.
Mm-hmm. And now it's just something that everybody uses, and I mean, it's all thanks to you, persevering and pushing that through, because like you said, it was something new, I suppose, right, at the time. And people just, like you said, didn't have the experience that you had about how important this this instrument was. Yeah.
Now they're picking it up. Now they're more interested.
And you've done so much work internationally, Shanti, including with key UN agencies. I know you spent a 4-year term as an expert member of the CEDAW committee. From just those 4 years, what would you say were some of the greatest lessons and takeaways, from all this work on the international front?
Yeah, you see, when I started working with CEDAW and observing the reviews of how the committee was drawing out from the government, making them see where they had failed, what they did well, but also where they had failed. Mm-hmm. And I had that interest around the year 2003, 2004, because my involvement with CEDAW was started even before I started Asia Pacific, late 80s. Then I was approached. Somebody suggested, why don't you get onto the CEDAW committee? And I had to think about it. Should I give up my work with Asia Pacific and get onto the CEDAW committee? What will that do for me or for women themselves? Then I sat and thought about it, and I said, the CEDAW committee of experts who sit and review governments They interpret standards. The Cedaw standards are interpreted by for women's human rights using the framework of Cedaw, and this is a very crucial function of this committee. Now, having worked as a civil society member, as a women's group member, promoting the human rights of women for more than, by that time it was more than 25 years, I thought I would be able to bring the realities of women's lives to this function of the Cedaw committee much more than somebody who gets onto the committee just being technically knowledgeable about the law, you know, the lawyers and so on. I would have much more ability to bring reality of life and would be able to provide perhaps a sharper analysis of the persistence of inequality. Whatever you do, sometimes it seems to rise up, that inequality. And what interventions do we... I began to think about that, in fact. And so that made me realize I could contribute. And I offered myself, the government has to nominate you, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has to go into a process of election, because many countries will be nominating their citizens. So in 2004, elections took place. I approached the Malaysian government to nominate me, and they agreed at that time. And I got through in the election, so it's a four-year term, each term for the Cedaw committee. So I sat there for the 4 years, and that was it. I didn't continue on that committee. I came back to my activism work.
Okay.
But sitting there, and during the 4 years, Cedaw committee meets three times a year, and reviews about at least 8 to 9 countries per session, three times a year. So it's about 24, 25 countries that are reviewed. And in the course of 4 years, I had sat on that committee looking at the performance and compliance of governments where equality and non-discrimination is concerned, about 100 countries of the world, of all kinds of countries, from the most developed to the most... developing, poor countries, rich countries, advanced countries. And again, I realized that equality has been achieved nowhere, not even in the most developed countries. The manifestations of inequality, which are very, very, what shall I say, harmful, is much more intense in poorer and smaller countries. You know, yeah. But the manifestations of inequality don't harm a woman that much in a more developed country, but it is there. Somehow, women do receive a certain level of ability to earn an income, education, health services are available, so the public services are much better, free education is available, and therefore it doesn't hit them. But when you come to the one area that has not changed worldwide, it is violence against women. Even in countries like Finland and Sweden and Iceland, which are top of the notch when it comes to gender equality, they call themselves the top countries for gender equality. They have put in quotas and gotten women into parliament. Very good percentage of women in parliament in Norway and all of those countries. But at the same time, women experience both domestic violence and sexual violence, rape, etc., within their own families. And secondly, the enforcement, they have good laws for domestic violence and everything else, and rape as well. But the enforcement of the law is as weak as it is in our countries. Prosecution is weak. Women hesitate to come and make reports, just as much as we, our women here, don't want to make reports. Violence is not reported even in those countries. And when it's reported, the prosecution does not take it up and prosecute it efficiently. They don't collect the evidence. So it's thrown out of court because of lack of evidence or whatever. And if it is prosecuted, then the conviction is weak, just as much as it is in our countries. And even if there is conviction, the penalties are minimal.
Mm.
Even in these big developed countries that say they are on the top of notch for gender equality. So, and then leadership and decision making is weak. They are high up, the developed countries are high up in political representation and participation because governments have put in reservations and quotas. It's compulsory. And the political system allows that to happen. But if you look at other areas, if you look at academia and women in as deans and in leadership positions in educational institutions, they are low. The other institutions, even in government service, they are civil service, they are much lower. Diplomatic service, they are lower. So they are lower in that kind of decision making and leadership. Is not up, it's not accepted even in those countries that women are leaders. And the gender division of labor is unchanged. Women, and even in these rich countries, are responsible for childcare.
Yeah.
You know, countries like Sweden and Denmark and all that have put in tremendous policies. That's a difference. The governments are trying, but society is still not ready in their countries. So in those countries, like Denmark and all that, they have provisions for flexible work, part-time work. So you can work for 2 years after childbirth in a part-time position, 3 days a week or something, so that
you can raise
2 days you're at home. Yeah. And they opened it up. The government has opened it up to men or women. Maternity leave after childbirth, only women take, whether it is 2 months or 3 months. After that, 2 years of family leave is given. A man or a woman can take it to look after the family and look after the babies.
Yeah.
Invariably, women are the one who are taking that. Because when you take that, you earn less, because you earn according to the amount of hours of work you're putting in. You won't get the same full-time salary.
Yeah.
Maternity leave, you will get full-time salary. That 3 months. But after that, you lose half pay only you'll get if you're half-time working.
Right.
And that affects your pensions, it affects your insurances and everything else. So the women earn consistently. There's a gender wage gap because of all these kinds of things. And in, I don't know if it's Denmark or Norway, government even said that this 2 years of part-time work, if must be equally taken by men and women. 1 year when men will take, 1 year women will take. Mothers will take, and 1 year fathers will take. And if a man doesn't take that leave, he doesn't want to take that leave, the family will lose it. The woman is not allowed to take the full 2 years.
Oh.
She can take 50% of it. The other 50% of that leave must be taken. See, the governments are trying to do all of that, and that is the difference between us and them. But society is still lagging for them behind. And it's still going on like that.
Okay.
I can go on and on. All that I learned when I was sitting on the CEDAW committee, what the governments have been doing to monitor and enable this equality in every sphere.
Okay.
And how it is also a struggle for the governments in those countries because society is still reluctant. And the burden comes on women. So if the man says, if the father says, I don't want to take this leave, the woman is so attached to her babies that she says, if the government will give us 2 years to look after this child, I don't want to leave this one-year-old in a daycare or somewhere. Let me stay back. She takes it on.
Yeah.
It's still happening. And she loses financially because of that. And the governments, when you question them, although they have put in place all these measures, they don't see it as problematic that the men are not taking it. They have said things like, oh, but it's a choice. The women are choosing to take the part-time work. It's their choice. This question of understanding what is choice for a woman is very flawed.
Mm.
Why would a woman choose happily to lose her seniority, the salaries that she can get, the money that she will lose? Why will she choose it? Because she has a different value system.
Mm.
She would rather lose financially than let her children not be cared for properly. So that mindset of a father versus a mother must change. So that is still a problem in all of these countries. This was very mind-boggling for me, how we think everything is perfect in these countries. They come up on the top of the gender equality index and all that.
But no,
it's there.
Okay.
It's there.
I guess, you know, just sort of looking back at 30, 40 years in this line of work, yes, of course, challenges still remain, right? But I mean, what are you most proud of in terms of your work? What do you count as your success or your successes?
You see, even in our countries, especially in developed countries, first of all, women have got a lot more awareness that they are losing out, although they still make these choices that are not good for them, but they know that they are losing out. And they're choosing still to come out and work. They're not completely staying at home. They realize that they must have a life of their own. They are beginning to see that that has happened. I mean, I don't say it just because of me, but it has happened because of this broad awareness. The world conferences also, World Conference on Women promoted this a lot. You have UN women agencies like that that are promoting it. So there is a whole global environment as well as at the national level that has promoted this. So women are much more conscious of their rights. And governments throughout the world, some better than others, are also putting in place certain public policy, institutional arrangements. See, even Malaysia has said they want a 30% of women in leadership position policy.
Yeah.
So at the policy level, even Malaysian government is saying, yeah, we will put this place in and make sure that women get this. So there are arrangements, institutional arrangements that are much more and accepted than by governments than before. Like even in Malaysia now, they are willing, how perfect that law will be, I don't know, on a sexual harassment law. We didn't have that. Now they are recognizing that there is such a thing as sexual harassment. The only problem that still exists, especially in our countries, in the less developed countries, is having put in place that kind of policy or even a law, there isn't enough monitoring of its implementation and seeing where is it still weak.
Yeah.
What capacity building do we have to give our personnel, our human resource persons in our ministries, that they will make sure that these laws will work for women? How do we collect data to know what is happening? Who is benefiting, who is not benefiting? What kinds of data? Although when reporting to the CEDAW committee, it's a very data-driven review process. The committee asks for a lot of data. But still the governments are not collecting that kind of data. They're very happy, oh, we've got the law, we've got this policy. So they think they've done everything as a result. So what I'm happy about is that governments are recognizing that institutional arrangements must be made, policies must be made. Women are recognizing their own rights a lot more and speaking up about it. So I think, and then law reform has been one area that has moved forward. Like we have the domestic violence law, we want government is agreeing to the sexual harassment, a gender equality law. So a lot of, in particular, a lot of awareness throughout the world and even in Asia on violence against women. That has moved a lot and that's a big achievement. But as I still said, the implementation is weak and governments must begin to collect the data. They are not collecting data. That is where we still need to push. And the framework of equality must underpin that is still weak even among women's groups. They go straight away into their theme. This is my theme and this is what I'm political participation. I'm pushing for political participation of women. But unless you ensure that everybody recognizes that women and men are equal and are equal right to political representation, as a right, you are still, you won't go forwards very much. There is a kind of something to say, okay, we put women into parliament, let's see whether the laws and policies that parliament makes is going to be better because women are there. That is not the only reason. Women had a right to be in decision making. You've got to recognize that right. So conceptually, ideologically, you must be more aware. So those are areas that still need to go. But women are pushing hard on a lot of things, and things are happening in that sense. Even in Asian countries, Malaysia included, more women have come into senior positions in their employment areas. So education has improved for women, definitely. Employment has improved, except Malaysia's employment labor force participation is still low. But even other poorer countries, Philippines and all that, they are top-notch now, labor force participation. Thailand even is better. Cambodia is better. So there are concrete gains. But the ideology of the equality of women and men still needs to be promoted.
Okay. All right. You know, there's so much that you shared, Shanti. And I guess, you know, looking back also, you know, what do you say was the most rewarding part of your work thus far? And I'll say thus far because, you know, you're still doing it. I don't think you're stopping anytime soon. But what would you say is the most rewarding?
I think for me to see women's groups being more and more articulate and vocal and younger women coming into the movement. Now I see a lot of younger women, and then I really laugh because when I'm at a meeting with some of the younger women, they have language, they use certain terminologies that I'm not familiar with. That is fine. I mean, I'm very amused when I see this. I can't speak their language sometimes. And they are so adept at the internet and IT and all that. Mm-hmm. And they are coming in with very innovative ways of putting out a message. Some of us, the older people, we were wordy people. You know, we have to say everything in long sentences.
Things have changed, huh?
Things have changed. But it's very refreshing, and I'm very happy to see younger women taking an interest, coming out, speaking about their own, recognizing their own rights, you know. That, for me, is very rewarding.
Okay. All right.
And the UN is also recognizing and trying to promote women's rights a lot more, although there's still a lot to be done. But I think with younger generations, younger people coming in into activism, a lot of things will change and will move. See, even this tribunal for me was a very rewarding experience of how we were able to organize a two-day event with 26 women talking about their violations. We would never have had that before. And very moving testimonies. They're willing to come and say, my rights have been violated. You, and some of them are middle-aged women, some of them are young women. And how we see that this technology, information technology, is a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
You use the information technology for many good things, including your activism and to promote your message. But that same technology can be used by others to violate your rights.
Yeah.
Stalking is done through information technology, you know.
Yeah, so many things. Doxing, yes, all these different, yeah.
You vilify somebody through Facebook and Twitter, and it has such a large audience.
Yeah.
Before, when you just write, you send a fax out at the most, you know, to a limited audience. Now you write one Twitter and it goes to the whole world. So we have to also use this information technology judiciously. But they're there. The young people are there. They know how to control it. So it's a whole new, different world. And I'm happy that it's taking a different face. All of this activism is taking a different way, but it is there. The activism is there. That is what is making me happy.
Okay. All right. Well, just before I let you go, Shanti, any last message that you'd like to leave us with, you know, to the listeners especially, you know, when it comes to fighting for equality and for human rights?
You see, my message constantly, wherever I speak to anybody, is that don't just promote a theme, whatever your theme may be, whether it's political representation or decision-making, health, etc. Always look for the equality and inequality question there. Understand how discrimination can occur, even in the theme that you're working, and fight unequivocally for the framework of equality to address everything you do, because if and have a clear understanding of what equality means. Otherwise, we will find that we are subverted by different understandings of equality, protectionism. I did a training recently, and I did an exercise, a case study of whether there was equality or whether there was inequality here. It was confusing even to the younger people. When they see a woman being protected, she's asked not to do something or go to certain places because it's dangerous. We want to keep you safe, so don't go into those places. Now, that is not equality. That is what is called protectionism. You're protecting somebody, but you're denying her options in life. You're curtailing her movement, her freedom of expression. So these women's groups now are strong on violence against women. You don't have to teach them about that at all. They can talk about discrimination, but we also have to talk about a lot, not only equality, but equality in the sphere of civil and political rights, freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, freedom of movement. Now, these are your rights too. If you don't, they are democracy rights. If you can't assemble and you can't speak freely of what you want to talk about, you will not promote your agenda. So we must widen our scope of what we understand of women's rights. Maternal mortality, reproductive health is women's rights. You know, violence against women, spousal abuse is women's rights, but you have to go beyond that. Because, you know, I do exercise, simple exercises, and ask people to tell me when they have been kind of sidelined and all that. And there was this situation that some women explain in another country, not here, that there was some kind of a funfair that was organized for the community, and part of it was the organizers, local government people they were, would, you can apply to them for a space, a tent that you can put up and have your own meeting inside it. The local government councillor sanctioned the tent meeting space for most of the men who applied, but he denied that space to the women. He said, no, I'm not going to give you this tent for you to sit down and chat inside. But the women, when they spoke about it, were all just talking about, he didn't give us a tent. He denied us the tent. I said, no, he denied you much more than that. Because they were not going to just sit there and chat and have a cup of coffee. They were going to talk about what was happening in their lives, which they were unhappy about. And they said, he denied you the right to discuss what changes you wanted in your life. Freedom of expression. He denied you a civil and political right, not just a tent. You could have gone out and bought a tent if that was the case. Yeah. But he denied you the space for discussion as women. So you have to go beyond the obvious and see what is underpinning this violation. What is the more critical violation here? So your analysis of what you see around you, this is any training, I still do some training, I tell them, understand the violation beneath it, the more critical violation that is beneath it, the ideological violation. So understand that ideology. This is what will be my message all the time. You cannot just be a concrete thinker, you know? Yeah, that's it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing, you know, all of that with us today. I've been speaking to Mary Shanti Dairiam. She's a human rights and women's rights advocate. She's been doing this for a long time. And again, if you miss any part of today's interview or any previous Good Things interviews, you can download the podcast at bfm.my or you can find it on the BFM app. This has been Good Things on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.